They're over in Korea with market forces, etc., etc., as ideology. It's the dominant ideology, not in the developed countries, not only in the so-called Western ones, but of course also in Eastern Europe. It's the way forward and so on and so forth. Now, it is not difficult to demolish, can you hear me if I stand at this distance from the mic? It is not difficult to demolish this as an ideology, but frankly, I assume that you've all done that in your own head, so I'm not going to spend a great deal of time on it. Instead, I start with Adam Smith. That is to say, I start with a serious argument, I repeat, a serious argument as to why capitalism actually, Smith didn't use the term still, actually was relatively so much more efficient than previous societies, about which he was right, by the way, the conclusion is right. Good. What was the argument? It went down, it went like this. Get rid of all the big central bureaucracies, including the monarchy, the police, the army, etc., etc. They are essentially parasitic. He described their work insofar as they work as unproductive labour. The labour that matters is the work that matters is the work that actually produces a surplus for reinvestment. That's the plus. Everything else is a minus, is negative. Some of it a necessary negative, an unfortunate evil. Why is this the case? Because if you allow people under free market conditions, that is to say, you can make what you like within limits and sell what you like, then actually the system has a built-in efficiency regulator. What is that? It's very simple. If Smith was talking about small-scale production, if I produce the wrong kind of shoes, no folk will buy them. Good, I go bust, and so do others, and I am replaced by people who are producing the right meaning what people want to buy. Yes, and because there are millions and millions of small producers, and there were in Smith's time, this ensures it's a sort of natural selection, that what is produced corresponds to what people want to buy. First point. Second point of Smith's thing, that in these circumstances, actually, the consumer gets not necessarily what he or she wants, but what he or she can afford. The system is consumer-driven. It's not the case that King George III, who was around at the time, decides what should be what you ought to want. You get what, assuming you can pay for it, what you actually want. And thirdly, the system is immensely flexible, because the possibility of shifting from one line or style to another is nearly infinite. Consequently, this is marvellous. Now, why was Smith concerned to produce these arguments? He was concerned to produce the argument against the then dominant semi-statist. I know these terms are a bit dodgy because words change their meaning at the time, protectionist and so on system, which partially existed in his time. He was a spokesman for the bourgeoisie, for the new developing industrial bourgeoisie. And he did tackle, he did not, unlike most modern defenders of the system, he did tackle the question of income distribution. Because when you say people get what they want, come on, how much have they got? Yes? And manifestly, the distribution of income is extraordinarily unequal. Right? Now, Smith tackled this problem, and this is what he had to say about it. He said, it is true. Why is it true? And this is an argument which Prinzberg has marked, because at the end of the day, not enough is produced, and therefore there must be inequality. It is a necessary condition for, to use modern terminology, capital accumulation. Smith's argument, subsequently elaborated into very complicated and sometimes intellectually impressive systems called, used to be called neoclassical economics, microeconomics, and so on and so forth. Some unfortunate individuals have to study these things in detail. Now let's look at the reality. The reality is, of course, that the system we live under cannot exist, not for a day, without planning. Why not? Well, what has changed? Many things.
What's the most significant thing that has changed between Smith's time and ours? It is the scale of production. Now, I mustn't spend too much time on these illustrations, but nevertheless, it takes, according to Boeing, I mean, I read this one about a year ago, 2 years ago, they were talking about a new generation of airliners. It takes, they claim, about 20 years from the recognition of the need for something new, the conception of something new, the research and development, the tooling, the prototype and so on, 20 years before the new Boeings actually fly. I mean, the radically new Boeings, you see. In other words, now, you can say that's an extreme example. Absolutely right. So let's take an everyday example. Electricity supply. Right, the whole economy depends on electricity supply. But it is not the case that actually, if suddenly the demand sharply increases, the supply can be rapidly increased. It can be increased to a point because they build in a reserve of capacity, or they did before privatisation. But actually, it takes to build a coal-fired station and get it functioning about 5 years. More than that slightly for oil-fired stations. Much, much more than that for nuclear stations. Yes, years and years and years. That's not responding to consumer demand. That is estimating what the demand is going to be X years ahead and planning on that basis. Now, that is the reality of the system today. Corporate planning. Now, that planning, of course, is carried out by a relatively small but still considerable number of independent, relatively independent enterprises. How the devil, then, do all the plans mesh? Well, short answer is they don't. Often, so you have a disaster. But people go bust. Or else you subsidise an expensive toy for the rich like Concorde, and so on and so forth. But by and large, the system works without an overall plan for two reasons. One is that demand to some extent is predictable. Now this is clear for some things. You can look at the pattern of demand, increasing or declining. Let's take an elementary commodity like bread. Now, actually, they can estimate what the consumption is likely to be, give or take a few loaves or a few thousands of loaves this time next year, the year after, and so on. The actual trend is for bread consumption to decline some of it, decline in Britain, declines at a constant rate. In other words, predictability of the market to some extent. The other thing, of course, is this. There's no, the notion, which was valid in Smith's time, that there is in a certain sense an autonomous market, that is to say, millions of people each making up their own minds and so on and so forth, doesn't now exist. Markets are shaped, markets are formed. Huge sums of money, real resources, are spent on shaping demand. It's called advertising, promotion, etc., etc. It's got ITV afloat. It is a large part of modern capitalism, a very wasteful part, and nevertheless a large part of modern capitalism. These two things taken together mean that from the point of view of matching what you produce and what people are persuaded they want to buy, works typically not too badly. I don't want to exaggerate the efficiency of the system, but actually it's not too bad from that point of view. Okay, let us note at the beginning, how going back to the beginning of this section, it depends on planning. The question is, who does the planning? Okay, now what is the driving force of this system? Well, the driving force of the system, according to Adam Smith, is what the consumer wants. It was Smith's world, economic world, is consumer-led. Yes? And actually, of course, it was much simpler then. There's no doubt that if more bread had been produced in 1776, more bread would have been eaten because there were lots of people who didn't get enough. Right? Now, consumer-led demand seems plausible. But actually, of course, the driving force is not now. It was not easy then. The question of consumer demand is important. But the driving force of capitalism is actually accumulation. The enterprise
may produce anything you like. Indeed, modern conglomerates, Hansen and all the rest of it, have a long list, I've read it in connection with this recent proposed takeover of ICI. They're producing, not all the goods God sends, but a whole range of things, you know, bricks, leisure centres, you name it. Actually, they're not in the business in order to make bricks, they're not in the business of producing leisure centres in order to provide you with nice leisure centres or any other of their multifarious activities. They are in the business of making money. Money. And if they find they can make money by some different kind of enterprise, some different kind of product, they'll just switch just like them. Given the time necessary, run-up time for production and so on, they'll produce the other thing. Money. Why money? Accumulation to expand the enterprise. Now, this is a very familiar to expand the capital. This is a very familiar argument, so I won't spend too much time on it. The dynamic of modern capitalism, actually, what capitalism is, industrial capitalism in general, is the accumulation of resources in order to expand the capital. And this is not because of some mental peculiarity of the people who are, you know, like the elder Rockefeller, John, the first one, that literally was 93, well into the 20th century. And he was so mean, that he used to go through his housekeeper's household accounts and argue with her about the price of a quarter of tea or something of this. The man had millions, countless millions. All right! He was a model capitalist, accumulate, and so on. But you don't need to be like that. We could be like Lord Hanson and spend it on wine, women and racehorses. Fact is, however, there is an objective constraint, a force independent of even the biggest capitalist, which compels him to act, or it, because it's an institution in this world. And that force is very simple. It depends on the existence of more than one capital, of a significant number of capitals around the world, right? It's not simply a question of what happens in Britain, what happens in Japan, the United States, the USSR, etc., etc. The driving force of capitalism is accumulation. And that, incidentally, produces a number of important side effects. One of them, of course, is instability. The system works relatively convulsively. We look, just not go back 20 years, recession, world recession in 70-71, not a very big one, much bigger one in 74-76, 80-81 again, 90 to what? We don't know yet, the present one. Now then, the cumulative waste in this process is truly enormous. There is nothing more wasteful, you know, talk about waste in the USSR, yes, it exists certainly on some scale, but my God, the cumulative effect of the waste of not idle resources, idle people, unemployment and so on is truly enormous. Enormous! We don't normally recognise this because naturally the media don't focus on such things. But we must remember that, first of all, instability. Secondly, growing inequality. Now, if we look at capitalism on a world scale, actually we see inequality is growing all the time. We take two cases, the relatively trivial case of Britain, and then the catastrophic case of sub-Saharan Africa, to see what market forces relatively unconstrained in. Well, inequality in Britain has been increasing over the last 15 years at least. Not I say 15, not 12 or 13. The process was already becoming marked under the Callaghan Labour government. But nevertheless, there has been, partly because of the operation of the system directly and partly because of tax changes in favour of the rich, to very considerably increase inequality. You can see it. You can see it in London. It's quite fantastic. When I was a kid, it was not unusual. This is back in the early 30s, you know, as soon as I can remember. It was not unusual to see in Manchester beggars. It was certainly not unusual for people to sleep out, to sleep rough and so on and so forth. Not the majority of the population, but it was not unusual. And then it disappeared. The second one, it simply disappeared. These unemployable people, these hopeless people, somehow or other they were integrated in the productive process, and because of things which we can't talk about in any serious sense now, the post-war boom, it stayed that way until comparatively recently. I mean, when I first saw it was at Finsbury Park, actually. A group of people who'd obviously spent the night on the pavement there, as we are 10 years ago now, I was quite shocked. Naive as I am, I thought, my God, this is back to Hardwick in the 30s. Actually, it's much worse than that now. Growing inequality, but that's the trivial case. Look at the impact of market forces on sub-Saharan Africa as a whole, right, excluding the Republic of South Africa. World Bank estimate, actual output, the value of actual output has declined by 10% in the course of the 80s, actually strictly speaking up to 89. That's catastrophic, because that population, diverse, few rich, somewhat larger number not badly off, and a great mass of poor. That great mass of poor was extremely poor to start with. Now, starvation, famine, etc. That's called market forces. That's the second feature. The third feature is the... Yes, no, I'm sorry, I'll leave aside the third feature and go quickly on to the fourth. No, I have to. I can say I'm going to be too long if I don't. The fourth, which is the most important one. The process of capital accumulation not only produces instability, recession and waste in the system on a vast scale, not only produces a growing inequality between those who have access to capital directly or indirectly and those who don't, it also enormously enhances the power of capital. What do we mean by the power of capital? Well, capital is an abstraction of the people who actually control large masses of capital. Now, this should be very familiar to people. All these arguments about, whatever you like, the exchange rate mechanism, and so on and so forth. Who decides? We don't function that way. Major, we are told, would love to reduce the rate of interest fairly drastically. Never mind what he actually thinks, I don't know, but it's in his electoral interest. He can't do it. He can't do it! Haven't been able to so far, except on a trivial scale. Why not? The Bundestag won't have it. Right? In other words, the power of a handful of people, and not just banks, a handful of people, relatively speaking, to make the major strategic economic decisions is much, much greater now than it has ever been. And the reason it's greater is very simple. It isn't only the mass, but the concentration of capital is so much greater. So much then for Adam Smith's vision. No, actually it's an important vision in his time, it's progressive, I would argue, in his time, and the current reality. Now let us look at planning. First of all, bit of an aside, planning is an ideology. There has been a real sea change in the what we call the orthodox established views of economists, politicians, etc., etc. For example, before, I mean in the period, first in the 30s and still on a much bigger scale, Second World War, 40s, 50s, well into the 60s. The notion that actually, under capitalism I'm talking about, an attempt to integrate in one way or another and to mitigate the effects of diverse capitals pursuing their own path and so on and so forth, to reduce waste and so on. There used to be a body called political and economic planning. Now this was not some left-wing notion, it was an eminently respectable bourgeois foundation, which used to produce plans for this, plans for that, etc., etc. They were taken very seriously by the Financial Times, the Economist, etc., etc. It corresponded with Keynesian notion that the level of economic activity as a whole, right, can, fundamentally important, can be regulated by state action. I don't criticise that. I'm merely pointing out that was the orthodoxy. The change is fantastic.
absolutely fantastic. Previously, I mustn't use this word, but I can't help it, Neanderthal economy, who had been pushed to the fringes. People like von Hayek, for God's sake, he was a joke. Not to us, simply, he was a joke to the bourgeoisie in the period I have been talking about. Actually, now, becomes respectable. And a nut to like Milton Friedman is actually allowed to advise the Chilean government, and he did, to wreck the Chilean economy. Now, there are social reasons for this change, which do not concern us. Our point is, the ideology of planning used to be taken for granted by our opponents. The argument was about who plans and in whose interest. Now then, change. It is now people on the left. Left in a generally defined sense, who produce arguments to show that planning is impossible. Quickly, there's the complexity argument. Well, Alex Nove, economics of feasible socialism, etc., etc., and a host of lesser grade imitators and so on. And the argument goes like this. Come on, millions of things, millions, literally, are produced every week. How can any planner or any planning body even know? You know, statistics are very dodgy, but in any case, how can they know what is needed and so on? So obviously they can't. Therefore, planning is impossible. He doesn't draw that conclusion quite so boldly, but many of his disciples do. Well now, we need to tackle this argument. I will tackle it. Well, later on, merely at this point, note that he is pointing to a real problem. The problem is not imaginary, and is not simply ideological. There is a real problem there. A second and fairly worthless objection, which has been increasingly fashionable. I read a book by a couple of American professors with the delightful names of Kay and Cracker. Now, recently, the argument is, without market forces, without a free market, there will be no innovation. Everything will be stagnant and so on and so forth. All we need to say about that is, actually, who carries on large-scale research and development now? Right, now, under the system. I do not say that it is impossible for a modern Arkwright scratching his head, looking at the equipment and saying, you know, I can do a bit better than this. That may still happen, but my God, that is not what has transformed the design and performance of motor cars in the last 15 years. What has done that is large-scale resources, large-scale research and development. Aircraft industry would never have existed, as a matter of fact, had it depended on modern Arkwright. Simply because the resources involved are so enormous. Whether they're efficient is another question. Efficiency is a dodgy concept. All we need note here is that the argument that with planning, research and development withers away, there's no innovation, is based on a set of false assumptions. There's no substance whatever in it. A third argument, however, needs to be taken seriously again. It is, look, forget the extremists, planning is possible, but you know, it is inevitably inefficient, it is inevitably bureaucratic and so on. Not just look at the USSR, but look at, as some of the more radical bourgeois critics do, the performance of, let us say, the General Motors Corporation. It's a vast bureaucracy, it's very inefficient, it's very wasteful, and so they say, you know, let's go into the argument in detail, which is why the Japanese, who are also large corporations, should be bureaucratic, are pulling the rug from under them. Now then, there is no doubt that there is an element of truth in this too. An element of truth under present conditions. No question about it, bureaucracies tend to expand. Just as at meetings, particularly committee meetings, where actually there isn't a great deal to discuss, the amount of talk expands to fill the time available. So, bureaucracies do indeed multiply without some force that cuts off, you know, the excrescences and so on. There's no question about that. We must talk about that too. Now then, let us talk about socialist planning. First of all, in general, and then in more detail. In general, the key question
is not whether to plan or not to plan. I repeat what I said much earlier. Without planning, and without, incidentally, rather dodgy long-term planning, modern capitalism could not work. The question is, who plans and in whose interests? Right? This is the key question. Who controls the process? Who directs the process? In whose interests? The whole question of class interests. And we know very well that a planned economy can operate with quite remarkable efficiency, as a matter of fact, if it concentrates on certain interests. There is a volume, I've forgotten which number it is now, there's an official British history of the Second World War, and it runs to 18 volumes, and in the days before libraries, public libraries were shredded, Manchester Public Libraries anyway, used to have these things, you know, the economics volume is very interesting, fascinating stuff, as a matter of fact, supporting more than 7 million non-producers in the armed forces, which is a hell of a lot, because actually they're not just a random 7 million, not say elderly people like me, they say the young, the productive, you know, all the rest of it. They draw in vast numbers of women into the workforce, eliminating a previous source of waste and so on, in spite of this enormous burden, and that it's not just the men, to some extent women, it's the equipment. This fantastic number of man-hours going into the production of Lancasters and so on and so forth. Actually, they maintained a level of production for civilian consumption which was, on average, higher than it had been in 1935. Notoriously, the nutrition of children improved. It improved very significantly. Malnutrition-associated diseases disappeared and so on and so forth. Because, what? Of a command economy. A command economy, however, directed to what end? To war. In whose interest? Basically the interest of the British bourgeoisie. Nevertheless, come on, none of this nonsense about, you know, you can't do this, you can't do that. They did. They did. Our rulers did. Because they had a vital interest in defeating the German ruling class. I'm not holding that up as a desirable model. But my God, because I can remember it well. But the statistics and anything like that, and then what actually happened, not a desirable model, but it illustrates the nonsense, you know, no multiplicity and all the rest of it. Innovation, for God's sake, what are you talking about? They developed jet aircraft, that's innovation, isn't it? They developed a whole host of things, very undesirable things, I better not go on about that, like the atom bomb. Okay, now, key question of planning, therefore, is, who plans in whose interest? Let us look briefly at the question of Stalinist planning. First of all, let's clear our minds of prejudice and also of emotion. It is impossible, really reads about the Stalinist period, the high Stalinist period, to feel anything but utter devotion. Leave that aside, we're talking about actual output, what happened to it, and so on and so forth. Basic truth is that wasteful, brutal, inefficient, and what have you, the Stalinist economy. I mean, go back, you've got to go back 20 years to see it, even when it was being modified in full flower, actually achieved rates of economic growth well in excess of the average non-economic rate. That's stagnant in the 20th century, but the United States and so on and so forth. As a matter of fact, there's only one serious competitor, it's Japan, and there are special reasons for that. How did they do this? Why don't we say it's a great thing? Well, some people did say it's a great thing. Ernest Mandel, for example, in his, not in some casual aside, I wouldn't quote, you know, I'm very fair, I wouldn't quote the man some off-the-cuff remark. No, no, he wrote a book called Marxist Economic Theory. Great fat thing, actually, it was two volumes originally, still got those, in which he says, Marxism guides, and not unsuccessfully, the economies of this, and it gives along this, the USSR, etc., etc., etc. Actually, it had nothing whatsoever to do with Marxism. It had to do with this fact. If you screw the working population, actually, you free substantial resources for investment and development, even if the process is wasteful, and it was very wasteful, I mean, the collectivization of agriculture,
a rational economic point of view, an absolute disaster. Never mind. So long as you can hold down real wages, and real wages declined, of course, in the high Stalinist period, they rose after the Second World War. If you can discipline the workforce, we have no unemployment. We have concentration camps for those buggers who either won't work or otherwise obstreperous, and so on. Then, of course, you can get a rapid economic growth. Why did it subsequently stagnate? Well, very simple, isn't it? First of all, contrary to the myths, and these myths have been fairly widespread in one form or another, not simply among Stalin's brother, but most people who regard themselves as anti-Stalinists, including a good many Trotskyists, or so-called Trotskyists. And indeed, Mandel was still going on. I pinched this from Chris Harmon. He wrote it in an article somewhere recently, you know. As late as 1981, Mandel was going on contrasting 1881 recession in the West, you see. But the economy of the USSR goes on growing 7% annually, which is a staggeringly high rate of growth for a mature economy. Actually, we know now, because